This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And with David Canfield.
Hi.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
We continue to be in the busy season for awards hopefuls, even though Oscar voting doesn't open for two more months, which tells you how much longer we have to go. But with AFI Fest in Los Angeles and various other screenings and movies premiering, there are a lot of new titles to talk about. We want to do a long-promised deep dive into the screenplays category, as well as answer some of your questions on subtext. And then at the end of the episode, we'll have two interviews. David talked to Cody Smith-McPhee of The Power of the Dog, and I talked to James Samuel, the director of The Harder They Fall. Lots of Westerns to get into. But first, we're going to start with the news, as usual. And I added this to the lineup at the last minute, and I linked to it, so hopefully you all saw what the line, Kirsten Dunst calling awards shrimps, means. but it's kind of exactly as promised. She did an interview with Lindsay Barr at the AP, her and Jane Campion together, I guess. And Kirsten Dunst explained that she and her friends, who are Kate and Laura and Kate Malavia of Redarte, call awards shrimps. So if a movie is a particularly awards-friendly, it's shrimpy. Do you guys feel like we should just adopt this without further explanation? And someone who misses this episode will just have to catch up on why we're doing this too.
What I liked about her explanation was that she's like, it's too embarrassing to talk literally about awards. So we just say, but they are still talking about awards. So, you know, there's a little bit of healthy shame, but also a bit of healthy enjoyment, which I think is a good explanation of this podcast to some extent. Maybe a little less shame.
The best part of that interview is how it gets brought up, which is Jane Campion turns to Kirsten and says, you called it a good shrimp, right? And
yeah, she immediately adopts it, yeah.
Jane Campion also seems like someone who would be, like, willing to embrace awards, but also slightly embarrassed by it. One of many good reasons they seem like a really good pair.
Indeed.
I feel like a lot of actors and directors are going to adopt this, because I think anytime I just, like, blatantly ask someone about award season, they get so stiff. And now I'm just going to be like, so the shrimp, how are the shrimp doing? And they're going to it's just going to be great. And then we're going to, you know, take that... What is that line from Forrest Gump where he, like, describes all the different kinds of shrimp?
Oh, yeah. Gumbo shrimp, coconut shrimp. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we could use that.
Well, Forrest Gump was a very shrimpy movie, as we all know. So.
Allison Wilmore from New York Magazine tweeted something in response to that she was going to call, like, really, like, strenuous award bait films the full shrimp cocktail, which I think is also a good evolution of the term.
Did you guys see the other Kirsten Dunst thing going around? She really is just such a wealth, where it's her and Nicole Kidman at an event on, like, a step and repeat. And you don't see the conversation. You just see in time for Kirsten Dunst to say, oh, my God, Nicole, I didn't know that.
Yes. And the audio's too good. It's like it's been planted. Yes, I've watched it like 20 times.
But what do you think Nicole Kidman just revealed to Kirsten Dunst? It's like the eternal question.
I used to be married to your Interview with a Vampire co-star.
I mean, Kirsten was pretty young back then. It was hard for her to get a grip on it. Well, someone, I think one of the tweet responses was, did you know that we filmed The Beguiled in Jennifer Coolidge's house? Which I hope is what they're talking about.
That's good.
Okay. As I said, I wanted to get into some of your questions. On Subtext, you can text us. Go to joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 213-513-7215. It really is such a great place for us to hear directly from you, and we can get right back to you. And I did want to answer one on the air because Courtney texted, and then someone else asked me if Taylor Swift's All Too Well short film would be eligible for the short film Oscars. And it's not. I'm sorry to be the one to tell you. It's only because of eligibility, because it didn't open in time. It would have had to open by the end of September to be eligible this year. So it could be eligible next year. Taylor Swift hasn't gotten an Oscar nomination yet, even though we keep thinking it will. So maybe it will be as a director. Stranger things have happened. And then the next question that this is going to throw to you pretty quickly, Richard, because Ryan wrote in asking about The Worst Person in the World and the fact that it's coming out in February 2022. Will it qualify for top 10 lists, including yours, Richard Lawson?
I emailed about that. We're being very enterprising on this episode and emailing people asking the tough questions. Yes, it had a quiet qualifying release, I believe, in Los Angeles a few weeks ago. So it is technically, it's a little bit of a fudge, but it is technically a 2021 movie. And, it was at all the film festivals. And so I'm counting it. Yes. And it will be on my list.
Does that feel like a good strategy for this movie in particular?
I think it is. I think that if you have such a long season and a movie like this would really benefit from a late surge. I think it makes as much sense as anything, to be honest. I'm now getting like some slight traumatic flashbacks to last year trying to figure out what movies were 2020 and which were 2021.
Oh, my God.
That was horrible.
Judas and the Black Messiah will forever live on is the great question mark. So for Worst Person in the World, though, for Oscars, like, is the international... So you're imagining, like, it gets nominated for international feature, and then everyone's like, oh, I want to check that out in February, which is when the Oscar nominations come out, and then it's right there in theaters. Is that the idea?
Yeah. The real Hail Mary hope would be that Renata Reinsvoog gets a nomination as well. Maybe not at the Oscars, but for other things. Like, maybe she wins at New York Film Critics or somewhere else, and that gives an extra boost, and so it has a little time. It worked for The Father.
Yeah.
That one's a good example. And even Nomadland opened, I think, in February on Hulu. After
Did it really?
Wow. After a qualifying, December or November release that I don't know that anyone was going to theaters back then. It just depends. And other studios are doing it. Oscar Farhadi's A Hero is opening in January, wide for that movie, after going qualifying. And I think it's already had its qualifying run. Or is that Worst Person in the World? I can't keep it straight.
I don't know. But it almost is it's weird because those qualifying runs matter for technicalities. But in terms of how people actually see them, even for critics, it could happen anytime, basically.
Yeah. And I wonder if there is some element that I'm not fully aware of, because this happens a lot more with foreign language films and international films. And I wonder if it has to do with appealing to the branch at the right time or getting a certain level of visibility, because I noticed over time that it does happen more with those movies.
And then one more question from Subtext that was extremely fun to answer and learn about myself from Will, who says, isn't there still a rule that the Academy can activate a Best Musical category if they decide there are enough contenders? There are a lot of musicals this year. What would it take? I saw this and I was like, that sounds made up. That can't possibly be true. And Rebecca, you found out it is true, although it won't work for this year for reasons maybe you can explain.
It was really fun to learn something new about the Oscars, because I thought we really knew everything. But it is true. There can be a Best Original Musical category, but for it to activate, as the language says, is nearly impossible. I mean, you have to have at least 10 contenders, and each contender has to have at least 5 original songs. So even if we're looking at the musicals this year, most of them are not original. They're from they're mostly from plays, right? So they're from the stage. So they don't, each of them, I think, has one original song. If you look at Dear Evan Hansen, they created a new song, but everything is pre-existing. So it is really interesting that this could happen, but I think the odds of us ever having a year of 10 original musical movies is slim.
we can dream.
I think another complication is that in order to activate it, you have to insert two keys at the same time and turn them. And Guild Cates was buried with one of those keys. So it's just the hope. All hope is lost, I think.
Yeah, there's some really weird language in the rules if you really dig in, you know, about the keys. They're hidden underground in the new museum. Yeah. It's very complicated.
People digging up through Hollywood Forever Cemetery trying to find...
Well, Rebecca, as you pointed out, the animation category actually works the same way. That has to be enough qualifying releases in the year for the category to happen. But that always happens because animated movies make money and musicals don't necessarily. So it's not the only category to operate in that kind of funny way.
Yes, exactly.
Well, again, please send us your weird specific questions. Even if we don't read them on the air, we'll try to answer them. You know, I feel like when you used to like write in like trivia questions to the newspaper to find out before Google, we can be the Google for very obscure awards questions. Okay, moving on to the news of the moment. Last week, we talked about how everyone was in LA and everyone was shaking hands. And then AFI Fest happened, and there was even more of that. And I think the biggest story out of AFI Fest, and for a festival that when we were talking last week, David, you know, thought might be a little bit quieter than years past, but Tick, Tick, Boom really had this big premiere at AFI Fest last week. And all of a sudden, it felt like my whole Twitter feed was swooning over this movie that, as I've hinted a few times, Rebecca and I both saw a while ago and were excited about and kind of had to keep under our hats. And David, I don't know if you were more of a skeptic, but you were kind of like waiting to see what was in store and you really loved it, right?
I loved it. I got to moderate a SAG screening of the film. So I really saw it under optimal conditions because I was in a room filled with actors who gasped every 10 seconds during a certain number, which I won't spoil, but which has, you know, chock full of surprises and that are very Company Town specific, let's say, or Broadway specific. And it's just... it's a really lovely movie that surprised me. I think Lin-Manuel Miranda's direction and overall handling of it is not less renty than I expected, but it's a little bit more nuanced and unexpected over the course of the movie. Andrew Garfield is really amazing. Robin De Jesus is particularly great in a key supporting role. And it played really well all week. They did a lot of screenings for it. The cast was out and about, and I think it's an interesting contender because, as we've been talking about, Netflix has a lot, but I think this one should not be underestimated because it has a lot of appeal to the biggest branch in the Academy.
And Richard, maybe you were the skeptic I was looking toward on this one because you know a lot about musicals, and I feel like you're always the one who I'm like, okay, wait, is it actually a good musical or is it just hype? And you really liked it too, right?
I did. Yeah. Katie, you and I were joking before recording that I went to go see the first preview of Company, the Broadway revival. Well, it was a London one. And anyway, every gay man in New York was there pretty much. And I talked to at least one of them pretty effusively about Tick, Tick, Boom. And he was kind of predisposed to like it. But another friend of mine who is kind of a little more hard-hearted, let's say, about big sentimental musicals also loved it. I have heard from nobody at this point who hasn't enjoyed it to some extent, which I think is a really interesting sort of broad appeal sign. And I'm one of those people. I thought it was much better than I thought it was going to be. And that's not to say anything about like which talent is involved. I mean, they've all done good stuff in the past, but I just something about the combination of it made me a little leery about how it was going to handle doing a Tick, Tick, Boom musical, but also doing kind of a Jonathan Larson biopic and a Rent origin story and all that. And I think it's just very well balanced. It's a really shrewdly made movie that also doesn't really, that shrewdness doesn't get in the way of its just big, broad sentiment. And, you know, I cried in the way I wanted to and felt uplifted and kind of encouraged about creativity. And it's really kind of a home run.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I think that is a movie that a lot of people are going into a little skeptical or nervous about being disappointed. And I think it's really going to serve that film well because it really does exceed those expectations. And I had a similar thing with King Richard. I feel like I went in sort of expecting a standard sports movie and it ended up being much more than that. So it's interesting to see these films that are kind of succeeding so much because they are a lot better than people are expecting.
Yeah, I think the Rent question of it, really does benefit this movie, because Rent, it was, you know, a huge touchstone for so many people, many of them around our age. And the movie adaptation was somewhat of a disappointment. But I think Tick, Tick, Boom is more than like Rent again. It has almost more depth to it, I think, because you have this one central character who's trying to achieve his artistic dreams. And we know that he did. And we know that he had this huge contribution to musical theater. So it's not like, you know, Roger trying to write like a mediocre rock song. Like it's much more powerful than that, I think. And Andrew Garfield at the center of it, I think it's just really hard to understate how, or hard to overstate how powerful he is in this. Like, he's just really wonderful, and he's been wonderful in a lot of different things. He got his only Oscar nomination for Hacksaw Ridge, which is one of the less wonderful things that he's done, but I'm just so excited to kind of see him move into this period of his life. And if he is in fact in the next Spider-Man, which I think he is, I don't know for sure, but I think he is, it's a very interesting fall for him, and that combination of things, and Tammy Faye out there too.
I think also we were talking about, you know, the activation of the Best Musical thing. Somewhere in that prophecy is Vanessa Hudgens is in a Best Picture nominee at the Oscars, right?
She's really good movie.
She is. And yeah, she gets just enough to do. I was kind of worried that she would be a bit sidelined because there's also Alexandra Shipp's character taking up some of the female singing parts. But like, she really makes an impression. She's done Mimi at the Hollywood Bowl, I believe, in a like a short kind of concert run of Rent. So she has experience with Jonathan Larson's material. And yeah, it's good for everyone involved, pretty much. Which, how often can you say that?
Yeah.
Yeah, Vanessa Hudgens also did the Rent live.
Yes, so that's what I was trying to think of.
So if she's in a Jonathan Larson musical, she's gonna do well. That's what we've learned.
Her hair looks unbelievable in this movie, which is not the important thing, but her hair looks.
And also was thinking that the whole time she was on screen.
And her main number is so much fun. It was one of my favorite parts of the movie.
Yeah, yeah, very, very like they both reach for the gun in Chicago. That number, which is totally really fun. I think the Lin-Manuel Miranda part of it is going to be really interesting to think about, because he's had a huge year, kind of quietly though, because In the Heights comes out and we've talked about how it kind of underperformed in a lot of ways. He had two animated musicals come out this year, Vivo, which was supposed to be a Sony release, I think, and is on Netflix, and it's pretty cute, I think. And then Encanto coming later. But I think for someone who was absolutely everywhere for a long time, and then I think intentionally scaled back, is not on Twitter every day, for him to come back with this as a director, a movie that he's not really in, he's got a small role in it, but I think it's a really good step for him. And I think his talent is, you know, continuing to expand at a point where I think many people were like, all right, he's the Hamilton guy, he's not that good, but he really does a good job with this.
I think we could talk about this with the adapted screenplay race when we get into it, but I do find it fascinating that Netflix has three debuts from very well-known people that have really surprised people in Passing, The Lost Daughter, and this.
Yeah.
It's a weird recurring theme of their season, and each exceeded expectations in their own way. And I think particularly with this one, Lin-Manuel being having idolized Jonathan Larson, and he credits him with getting into musical theater in the first place, the way he was able to interpret that and show some restraint at times in telling his story and make leave room for nuance I was really impressed by the whole thing he did with it.
I can't wait to hear him and Maggie Gyllenhaal talk to each other about their road to directing. Okay, yeah, we do want to talk about screenplays, but let's continue on the AFI premieres beat, because speaking of King Richard, like you were saying, Rebecca, it premiered at AFI. It feels like it's played everywhere on earth, but also is still premiering, and it will be on HBO Max soon. But David, you were at the after party for that premiere. I assume King Richard is continuing to charm everybody who encounters it, right?
Yes, I also went to a SAG screening of King Richard for unrelated reasons.
Did you join SAG, David, and didn't tell us?
I might be on the nominating committee. No comment. My credits are slowly building up now. But that was another one that played extremely well. And then I did go to the party for that film, and it's just wild to be in a room with Will Smith and the Williams sisters, and the star power really showcases one advantage of this film in terms of its Best Picture campaign, is it's just so many faces that are so iconic coming together for a movie that people really like, and that's not to be underestimated, and I really felt that this past week.
Yeah, I think anytime Hollywood gets a visit from stars of another field, it helps during award season. So the way they decide to bring out Serena and Venus, I think, will be really smart for them because, yeah, I mean, Hollywood people just love seeing an athlete or a musician or someone just dropping by a party. I just like elevate.
That's so funny. Imagine people just being like dumbstruck by like Leonardo DiCaprio, like cannot believe he's in the same room as Billie Eilish. It's totally true. You see that happen plenty.
We used to get really excited in college when someone who wasn't a theater major would show up on audition for a play and they were just like the new exotic thing if they got cast.
Same
What's
thing.
Your world like? Tell us. Yeah.
And last week, I hinted that Rebecca had a piece on Swan Song, which was also premiering at AFI Fest. And that is up now. You can read about kind of the making of that film. And I saw it as well. I was kind of seeing tweets from the premiere where, you know, the whole room is in tears, which is, you know, this movie really is a solid tearjerker, perhaps more than anything else this season. And Rebecca, you and I think have both been enthusiastic about Mahershala Ali's performance. After the AFI premiere, do you think he's in a good spot?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really hopeful that, you know, people will appreciate this performance because it is so good and so difficult because he is playing two versions of his character opposite each other. And I just think he's so talented and it's such a deep performance, which I'm sure is what led to all the tears at the screening. You know, the film is Apple and they're, I think, still figuring out their awards season strategy. So I just hope it doesn't get lost because it's a really special performance that I will probably be stumping for every week on this podcast.
I had to kind of chase publicists for even any screening info about that, you know? And it's like, if you have this big Mahershala Ali performance, you know, like, why? I don't know. It's funny that it's sort of arriving very late and sort of unheralded. And there was another movie with Udo Kier called Swan Song that came out just a few months ago. So maybe there's a branding problem as well. Not that tons of people saw the Udo Kier movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, between that and Coda, which I also really, really loved, I just hope Apple can figure out a strategy that works because I think they do have some strong performances to show off this season.
Talk about Tearjerker and Coda. Like, that's a that's a powerful double feature between the two of them. I can see Swan Song playing well at home, though. You know, if for people who have Apple TV and know that there are movies on it, which is, I think, always a question. it'll be out December 17th. Like, it's a movie that I think a wide range of, you know, family members generationally could watch. I've been thinking the same thing about King Richard on HBO Max next week. Like, if you're at home with your parents, like, that is a movie every single person can put on. So, you know, we're right now in the period where everyone's getting out and going to screenings. And then over the holidays, everyone gets their links and their discs and kind of hunkers down. So it's interesting to see what takes off in that period.
There are going to be some heartbreakers in Best Actor for sure. There are just too many big contenders there. And once precursor noms start rolling in, there will be some, you know, people who are left out of the conversation who maybe we weren't expecting. And conversely, like, there's a lot of great performances here and some we may not be giving enough of a shot, may have more of one than we think.
I mean, yeah. Garfield's definitely in, right?
Like, I think Garfield is in. I do think the movie's playing well enough and it's just such a moment for him. I would be surprised if he didn't make it in.
Yeah. One last LA premiere to talk about before we dive into screenplays, being The Ricardos, played on Saturday in LA. It wasn't part of AFI Fest, right? It was just a premiere. David and Rebecca, do you guys remember?
It was more of a tastemaker screening.
Okay.
So just starting to get it out to people who will tweet things about it after they see it.
Well, lots of people did.
It was a SAG screening as well, I should add.
Okay. And then everyone who was in the room, which does not include any of us, unfortunately, but it just played really well to the room, according to everyone who was there. I think it's actually not as much in the Best Actor race, but, you know, Nicole Kidman was getting her share of attention for it. And, you know, playing a very famous real person has worked out well in many an actress race. I think, as opposed to Best Actor, I think actress is fuzzy enough where you could see her popping in there. But I mean, I was kind of wondering if being The Ricardos was going to be a significant contender. And it seems like after this weekend, it's right in there, right?
Yeah. I mean, Rebecca and I have saw possibly an earlier cut of the movie. So we'll have to see the finished version before fully commenting. But I am waiting for reviews on this one and a broader reaction. I remain a little bit skeptical about its chances overall.
Does it feel kind of like those like Marvel premieres where like hours later everyone's raving and then like 2 days later there's the second wave of more measured takes?
Not unlike that.
Okay.
I do think also because it is a movie about making a TV show, it just plays really well to industry audiences, you know, and there's a lot of that language of being in a writer's room that, you know, people just eat up. So yeah, I mean, as we're saying, that I think that was a very friendly audience for that movie. And it's Nicole Kidman, you know, I mean, and J.K. Simmons. And, you know, these are actors that actors love to watch. So I'm definitely waiting to see more reactions as well.
And to your earlier point, Rebecca, about going into, say, King Richard or Tick, Tick, Boom with lower expectations, there was a lot of really negative buzz around Nicole Kidman, specifically her casting in this movie, which Rebecca and I knew that was pretty unwarranted, having seen something. Mm-hmm. So I would guess that people were just pleasantly surprised that she's not bad in the movie at all. Sometimes that can influence a general
reaction.
That's
what Nicole was telling Kirsten Dunst. She was like, you know, that was me playing Lucy, right?
I mean, the trailer that have come out, it's a really impressive feat. And I think every year we kind of struggle with, like, well, they look and sound a lot like this famous person. But is that, like, what does that make it a performance? Like, and this could be another interesting place to get into that. Although she's done really well playing real people in the past. So doubting her might be foolish.
I think also, whatever you might think about Sorkin, when the right actor just tucks into his kind of verbosity, it really registers for people, you know.
Yeah.
Like, maybe it didn't work for Chastain and Molly's Game, but, like, you know, I think Nicole Kidman has a bit higher profile than that. And I don't know, I'm seeing it tonight. I'm all of a sudden excited for it in a way that I hadn't been before.
I really hope Nina Arianda gets some attention for supporting actress. I think she's the real standout of this movie and deserves it.
I was a huge fan of Chicago 7, which didn't necessarily work for everybody. So I'm ready. Well, we're talking about Sorkin, so let's go to screenplays. He is in the original screenplay category, which is the thinner one this year, while still having plenty going on in there. But I think when we get to adapted, we might talk about why that's a lot more competitive. But really, you know, if you look at the earlier predictions, it's him and PTA up there elbow to elbow against each other. But I think that the category gets more interesting maybe when you look beyond the big names. So what, Rebecca, of the original screenplay people, what are you most interested by?
Well, guys, I'm going to bring up Belfast again because I haven't done it yet. We're however many minutes into this podcast. But, you know, it like I think we actually don't talk about it that much because it's so clearly in the sort of top front runner group for a lot of these categories. But I do think it has a chance. You know, Kenneth Branagh wrote the screenplay along with directing it. And then I would say the other, it feels sort of like a lock to me, maybe, is King Richard, because, again, it's playing really well, very wide. So I do think it has a strong chance to get in for screenplay as well.
And it's very talky, King Richard.
Very talky.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I just want to say, Rebecca, I hope that Kenneth Branagh returns your family to you now that you have held up your end of the bargain.
They're having a great time with Kenneth Branagh. Yeah, he's a joy to be around. He's reciting Shakespeare.
Licorice Pizza's interesting. I reviewed it this week, and I think I was a little bit cooler on it than some of my critic colleagues were. But as a screenplay, it's very meandering, and it kind of sort of comes to a conclusion at the end, but it's really sort of a mood piece. And I just wonder, I mean, I guess the writers are the ones who are nominating for, right? Like, it's not like the whole Academy voting on it at first. Yeah. So, like, maybe I guess I could still see them appreciating the structure of it, or the sort of lack of structure or deceptive lack of structure. But I don't know. I don't know if I see it going all the way to the win just because it doesn't quite tell a story in the traditional sense in the way that some of these other ones we're talking about do.
I think it will. polite disagree. I do think that the movie is really well positioned because, as Rebecca mentioned, you have Belfast and King Richard here, which I think don't necessarily pop for their screenplays. They would get in as overall best picture contenders, and I do think they're at least near locks to be nominated here. PTA has not won in 8 nominations. The film right now is at 100 on Rotten Tomatoes and 95 on Metacritic. So it's going to stand as one of his more overall best reviewed films. And I think it is worth mentioning that the writer's branch particularly has really gravitated toward his work. They nominated the Inherent Vice screenplay, even though that was very much not an Academy movie. And I think this one will play more broadly than most any of his other films. it just feels like there is a path there. I do agree, Richard, that the script itself is not necessarily one you would think of as an obvious kind of screenplay winner, but I do think its overall accessibility, it's really funny, it's really heartfelt, and the combination of that and the narrative he has going into it and the shape of the category, I do think he has a clear lane. I don't think it's sewn up yet, but he would be my prediction right now.
And most crucially, maybe it appeals to nostalgia. You know, yes. Which, like, you know, for 50-somethings now, I guess it would be like, they're like, oh, I remember California in 1973. You know, it does have that kind of tang to it that clearly, if you know, there's a lot of nostalgic stuff kind of in, you know, in the running already with Ricardo's and Belfast and all that. Like, people like that kind of thing. And so, and also the he's due kind of narrative will help.
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that Paul Thomas Anderson does not have an Oscar will feel egregious at some point. Maybe this is the year that it does. I mean, I think original screenplay has historically been the place for the kind of like odd duck in there. You know, you think of like the indies that wouldn't get nominated for Best Picture, and the Academy has changed a lot over the years. And I don't think there's anything that really fits that bill this year, but I am rooting hard for Mass, written and directed by Frank Kranz, previous guest on this show. It does seem like the kind of like low key, small movie that could work really hard to get a nomination here and deserve the attention that it gets. Any other kind of wild cards you guys are looking towards?
I'm hoping Mike Mills gets in for Come On, Come On.
Is that a wild card at this point? I guess it is.
I think if you have Belfast and King Richard, and also Adam McKay is not to be underestimated for at least screenplay. None of us have seen Don't Look Up yet, but that screens Thursday. The social embargo for that will be up, I guess, as of this recording being up, but we have not seen it yet. So that's one to look out for. And then you have people like Sorkin and even Wes Anderson. That movie did pretty well in theaters, and the writer's branch likes him a lot. So it's not a lock. I would like to think that he will find a way in, but that movie is playing a little under the radar right now.
Do we think that Parallel Mothers, Almodovar, like, has a chance? Because I've seen it predicted here and there, obviously more for Penelope Cruz's performance, but like, I don't know, maybe they could throw a foreign one into the mix.
Yeah, I think that and A Hero are both in the mix for it. Parallel Mothers is an interesting case right now. I'm struggling to get a sense of exactly how it's playing beyond it getting, you know, being a critical hit. It's had a really gradual rollout from Sony Classics, but they really believe in it. And I think they really want it to be an across-the-board player. But I don't know if I've quite seen that yet, but we'll see.
I do feel like Sony Classics, that's kind of their style almost.
Yes.
Like they're quiet in the grass, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, there's the lion when they land on nomination. So
and it's Anthony Hopkins, so suddenly he has a second Oscar.
Yeah, it's definitely worked for them in the past. So I wouldn't underestimate them as well. And I feel like my pick, if I could have one addition, is Bergman Island, but I know it's a long, long shot, but it feels like it was such a great script. So that would be my vote.
Come join my voting block at New York Film Critics Circle, Rebecca. We can make it happen.
Good. Okay. I'll move to New York for that.
Yeah, establish residency for the week-long period that they require. So let's hop over to Adapted, where, I don't know that it's more competitive. It just feels like this is a year of a bunch of really high-profile adaptations, where you've got, as we mentioned, Power of the Dog, Tick, Tick, Boom, and Lost Daughter, and Passing, all coming from Netflix, which is quite a combo. Dune is in there. Nightmare Alley from Guillermo del Toro is in there. It's Macbeth. They adapted Shakespeare, and it's Kenneth Branagh for once. And I don't know really what I would give the edge to at this point. It's early time to try to pick a winner of anything, but does it feel like anything has the edge?
Power of the Dog.
Yeah.
Power of the Dog. Yeah. So much so that I almost worry that because she, to me, is pretty clearly out front here, Jane Campion, does that at all hurt her in director? And I don't know the answer to it, and I hope it doesn't, but we've seen these kinds of conversations pop up before where it's like, well, we know this person's winning here, and especially if it's not an across-the-board, like, Best Picture front runner, which, you know, maybe Power of the Dog will emerge as that. But right now, I think it's clearly up front here, which hopefully won't be to its detriment otherwise.
It feels like such a wasted opportunity, not wasted opportunity, a missed opportunity. Jane Campion has a screenplay Oscar. She would be the second woman to win Best Director. Like, that feels like such a compelling narrative to me that I hope it wouldn't trip people up. I mean, give her both, honestly. But if you're going to have to pick one, like, Director seems like such the one to give her.
Yeah, and you have I think what Maggie Gyllenhaal did with Lost Daughter was pretty fascinating. And Rebecca Hall with Passing, I should add, you know, both really rigorous, intense adaptations of material that's really nuanced and tricky and maybe tough to realize for the screen. And I think they both did a really fascinating job. Another one that we probably should talk about is West Side Story, which is adapted by Tony Kushner.
Heard of him.
who is not probably not to be underestimated here. But another one that's sight unseen right now.
The Campion thing, I just looked like, you know, like Bong Joon-ho, one director and screenplay, 2019, Inarritu did it for Birdman, you know, so it's not like it's been so long that someone has won both, you know, like it can easily happen.
Yeah.
Tony Kushner doesn't have an Oscar. I just feel the need to point. Anytime I'm given a chance to talk about how the Oscars treated Lincoln badly, I will, because I love that movie. West Side Story would be it feels like a strange Oscar for Tony Kushner, but everyone wants him to have one, I assume. That one is showing late after Thanksgiving, so we still have a little bit longer to live in that mystery, I guess.
Isn't the rumor, Katie, that Peggy Siegel had something to do with Lincoln's Oscar?
Was she backing Argo that year?
She was not given Lincoln as a property for when she was doing her work in New York, and so she's like, out of spite, the rumor is, kind of helped or tried to sink it. I don't know if she was actually that powerful. That's probably a story coming from her, but
that does seem about right. David, when you were talking about tricky adaptations for The Lost Daughter and Passing, I was also thinking about Dune, which I think got its share of knocks for being half of a book, but what does seem like an incredibly difficult adaptation, like one that has stymied many people in the past. And it doesn't seem like the most obvious screenplay nominee because it's got so much else going for it, but I would really like to see it in here.
Yeah, I would too. And I think that because it's considered such an not an unfilmable book, but a book that's extremely difficult to thoroughly adapt. And Denis mostly got credit for doing that. It's definitely in the conversation. It just depends on how stuff like Nightmare Alley and West Side Story play, because those are potential overall Best Picture players that, like where you have King Richard and Belfast on the original side, could kind of get grouped in here with all these really interesting, slightly smaller movies. Because we also have stuff like The Humans from A24, which is not going to be the most popular movie, but I think is a really really delicate transition from stage to screen there, and one that maybe we'll get discussed a little bit here. So you have a mix of big and small in a lot of cases.
I think Dune, to me, I feel like it has a chance because you have to remember it's the writers voting. And I think a lot of them would probably think, how would I have adapted that book? Oh, I could not have adapted that book. So, you know, that gives them sort of an incentive to, you know, respect what was done with it. The other one I'm kind of curious about is Macbeth. You know, I think people feel how they feel about the movie, but, you know, it is adapting Shakespeare, and it's Joel Cohen, obviously. So I do wonder if that's going to get some momentum down the line.
And people are really familiar with that IP, you know?
Yeah. So.
and we mentioned Coda, right? That has a pretty, I think, strong shot of getting a nomination here.
Yeah, I think it's another one that
yeah.
We had a question from Rory on subtext about Macbeth, saying we didn't mention it at all on the previous episode, and asked if the steam was running out on that. It does feel, in screenplay and kind of elsewhere, I think it's a big question mark, because it premiered at New York Film Festival and has been kind of hanging out in the ether until then. But it could be primed for a resurgence. I'm not sure what's going to happen with it next.
Yeah, I think it's about keeping it in the conversation. You know, we're talking about actors who don't do a lot of press and director that doesn't do a lot of press. So I think it'll be a challenge to keep it relevant.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really tough road for that movie in the awards conversation. Even Denzel Washington, who I think is pretty safe for a nom, but as that category keeps getting more and more competitive, he may be one of those people who we're surprised to see left off of some lists in the coming months.
To dive into subtext again and back on the screenplays topic, because Tess asked us about wild cards that we would want to look out for, and we talked about some over an original, but she mentioned Zola and The Green Knight, which are two screenplays I would just be thrilled to see show up and adapted. I think both of them have a pretty long road ahead. Zola feels like it it should come back and be talked about at some point. It's got such a pedigree with Jeremy O'Harris writing that script. Do you guys think that's possible?
Well, it popped up at Gotham's, right?
Yeah.
Got some nominations there. So, yeah, I think that I would look at that for critics prizes and things like that in Spirit Awards, whatnot. I don't know if that will translate into, I think just not enough people saw that movie, you know, and A24 has other priorities at this point. So, yeah, I'd be curious. Now I want to see a movie called Zola and the Green Knight.
I would watch that for sure.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, to jump to the interview portion of the show, first, let's hear from David, who talked to Cody Smit-McPhee, who is in The Power of the Dog, a movie we keep talking about and will keep talking about, and he's really wonderful in it. So, David, can you tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear?
We'll hear from him at the near end of a months-long press tour for this movie, who's a little exhausted, but also kind of thrilled by it, and It was really interesting to catch him at this moment, because the movie has been touring literally the world nonstop since the beginning of September. And he's been right there the whole time. And this is a new experience for him for sure. And I think rightly getting a lot of Oscar buzz for it.
All right. Let's hear that interview.
I love your performance in this film, and I've been excited to talk to you about it. And it's interesting because I saw the film before, people were allowed to talk about it. And even after that, it's still, your role particularly is a hard one to talk about, because so much of the film hinges on reveals with the character that, you know, the film is finally just coming out, but, you know, most people have not seen it yet. How have you found talking about it?
Good question, man. Thank you. Because a lot of people will lead in with describe your character, and it's the hardest thing ever to do without giving away too much. But also, you know, we're marketing here. You have to anchor people in or hook them in with why this story is so beautiful and why your character is so interesting and intriguing. It's really a hard task with Peter, because he has so much that's internalized and so much that you don't want to give away. And a great deal of his character arc has to do with judgments about him initially and what they end up resolving themselves to be. So, yeah, you have to be very kind of tiptoe around talking about him. But yeah, I think that in and of itself is intriguing and you know, makes people want to check it out.
Yeah. Well, in the broadest way, how did Peter strike you before you auditioned, before you talked about it with anyone? How did he kind of immediately come off the page to you?
I feel as if while I'm reading it in the best way I can, I try and represent what the audience's journey will be on it. I'm going through it, watching it. And just a lot of these kind of judgments arise with Peter and for Phil as well. And it's just a lot in how they initially carry themselves and respond to other, characters. But I just love the way that by the end of the movie, it forces you to kind of recontextualize and reconsider everything that you initially thought about the movie and about the characters. I absolutely love movies like that. And I always have wanted to be a part of one that is deserving of its twist. I can't stand movies that just, pull the rug out from underneath you at the end and it's not deserved. Yeah. So this is all of that. It was very exciting to read in consideration of it and to be considered. And then the audition process was just, it was really lovely because I went into it thinking it was just a conversation, really, a general meeting, which I think it was. And I think Jane just loves to put people on the spot. That's my idea that I took away from it. But I really loved it because it gave me a great sense of freedom, because she just asked me to uplift Peter into the room and so she could explore him and ask questions from my perspective, from what I took from the script and my adaption of him, I guess. And then I think we did a cold read as well. So it was all very on the spot. It was all improv, but at the same time, that is a lot more forgiving in many ways than the traditional kind of cattle call casting auditions in LA, where you have to prepare 16 pages and do it in like 2 minutes in front of, you know, people that you really admire.
Right. Well, I spoke with Jane about you, and she told me that when you walked in, she knew you were better than Peter. She said better than the boy in the book is how she phrased it, which is, well done. That's high praise, but it's also probably a high bar to clear and deliver.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, that's what I do have to say, is that when it comes to the portrayal of a character, obviously a lot is left to chance and the perfect storm of who you are and how your parallels relate to the character itself. So there's a lot that is not of my doing, but at the same time, I think in the things that I expressed about him and the reasons why I think I understood and loved him so much just made sense and correlated later with, you know, the understanding that Jane had of him, which was a really beautiful feeling.
In terms of the fact that he existed both on the page and in the book, on the script and in the book, I should say, from The Road to this, with some stuff in between, you've acted in quite a few adaptations of, you know, pretty highly regarded books. Do you like to work off of both the script and the book? Has it evolved for you? What was it like with this particular project?
Actually, yeah, from the first movie I did called Romulus, My Father, that was an adaptation of a true story. Then we went on to The Road, and that has definitely been a reoccurring theme. And since, you know, my father taught me everything I know in terms of the foundation of my approach in acting, we worked the book rigorously and drained it of everything it was worth, you know, back in my early days. So that's something that I continue today. And I think, I mean, obviously that's a no-brainer, because for an actor, for me personally, I tend to fill in the blanks for things that aren't provided in the script. But of course, it's always better if you have some kind of source material. And especially when it's a book, you can't always fit everything in the book into the movie just for timing reasons. So it's cool to have that there in your artillery to kind of bounce off of, because there's a lot of things in there that you can kind of hide within yourself or find inspiration or influence from that the audience doesn't have to know, but can help a great deal with your character.
It's interesting too, because to an extent, the book also has the same mysteries as the movie as you're reading it. So it kind of gives you a different way of trying to figure out what's going on with Peter and the whole story, really.
Definitely. There's this layer of ambiguity across the whole script and the book. And I guess it's led by this sense of like impending doom that keeps you on the edge of your seat. But somehow you find yourself on the edge of your seat while it is a patient and slow kind of burn. Which I think is very rare to find. And I mean, that's the genius of the book, but also in the adaptation of Jane Campion.
Can you talk about some of the techniques you employed for this? I saw Jane introduce you to the Alexander method, which is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, my dad had actually introduced me to elements of the Alexander technique when I was, you know, from the get-go, when I was 8 years old. But it was just portions of all of these different versions of classical training that he had experienced and passed on to me. And he passed on to me the portions in which he felt were most valuable. So I've always had these tools there and I've always applied them, but I really loved how Jane challenged me and invited me to take them to their most extent, to commit to them completely, I guess. And so instead of just like, you know, writing and studying things in a journal, I completely embodied the idea that, you know, a fox might be similar in its characteristics to Peter. So, you know, crawling around on the ground and things like that, I think really help you discover more. And then I guess just rediscovering things that you don't really think about because you did them so long ago, like a dialect coach. I had to work with many of them when I was younger, obviously being Australian and, you know, doing American and Scottish, Irish, German roles. And it's something I pick up quite quickly. But to revisit it's not a bad thing. You know, I think we're always a student of our craft. So it's healthy and it's rewarding to step out of your comfort zone. And that's what she forced me to do.
What was that like in the context of the ensemble? Because I know Benedict got to try something a little bit new in terms of going more method, and you have other actors there who have been working for a long time, who have their own styles. So for you, was there a kind of give and take there? What was that like?
I find that she challenged everyone, and that's even outside of actors, like Ari Wagner, the cinematographer. You know, we've had discussions now that we've been going on this press tour, and I found that she was challenged in the same ways, which is really cool to find that Jane has that in her to, you know, adapt to people and find where they can unleash their potential that bit further, you know, or find areas that they haven't explored in themselves or need to re-explore. I find that fascinating. It's almost as if we all went through a Jane Campion boot camp. But yeah, they were all very different methods. You know, Benedict took on the actual method approach. I'm not really sure what Kirsten had done with her. I think one of the most important parts is anything that we were challenged in taking up was a very intimate thing. You know, it was when we would have one-on-one time with Jane that we would have the freedom to explore such places. So I think that's an important part of it.
So beyond the prep and into the actual performance, can you speak to anything that felt for you new or maybe a little bit more daring in terms of playing to the camera and playing Peter?
Yeah, I would say specifically the body movement specialist that I worked with, not the Alexander Technique one, but there was a following one that I had worked with in New Zealand. And that was to really just kind of rewire my habits and my tendencies, you know, physically, you know, the way that I walk, the way that I stand, the way that I run, and to completely embody the ideas and the essence of Peter into my physicality, which of course was something that I was already going to do before, but I don't think to the extent in which I discovered in actually working with someone that specializes in that world. There's a great sense of kind of humility, I think, in that task and in collaborating with someone else and letting them kind of guide you. And I think that really made Peter who he is. And like I said, same goes for the dialect coach. Like, it wasn't so much the American accent that we had to work on, but his lisp and what level did we want to do it at? I would have originally done something that would have been a bit more downplayed, but Jane wanted me to take a bit more risk. And so it was just lovely to be able to know that I could trust Jane in being pushed in those ways and just surrender and go on for the ride and enjoy it. And to find how rewarding that was in the end is the most fulfilling part.
Mm-hmm. Did you think about the reveals of the film in the context of the way you played it, like having certain things pay off going in, you know, as we're watching deeper into the film?
Yeah, we have conversations about it, but I think the beauty of working with Jane is that her mind as a director, she took it upon herself. That's her job to direct us in that way, you know. I'm someone as just like the intellectual, and I don't know, I rationally like to plan things out and think of them from the third person and objectively, subjectively. She just kind of erased all that from me and said that that was her part to do, and I just had to focus on the moment and on Peter. Which is something I'm sure my dad could agree with. I guess over the years, I've let my own mind and judgments come into the play a bit more. But yeah, she let me, I guess, if anything, not think about those things. To where before I would have explored those ideas, I would have thought, is the audience picking up what we're leaving? It was such a relief to just let all of that go, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You said that this role feels a bit like a paying off for everything you've been working toward in your career. Can you speak to that a little bit in terms of what this particular project means for you and the journey you've been on so far and where you can go from here?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really personal journey for me. My career goes hand in hand with my life because I feel, you know, my family had to sacrifice a lot to achieve, you know, what we have. And we came from just a very, I guess, quote unquote, normal lifestyle in Melbourne, Australia. And it was just the happenstance of my dad asking me if I wanted to do acting for fun that got me here today. I'm really blessed that, you know, in the beginning, early stages of my journey, I got to work so closely with my dad. And every time I work on any character, I hear the echo of his, you know, technique and process, you know, working with me as I've adopted it now. And I just guess getting to this point to be able to work with someone like Jane and the whole ensemble and to do an adaptation of a story that is a real icon in American literature, it's very special, but mainly just that response, that warm response that has been so consistent throughout all of the festivals. And, you know, I trust that it will be internationally. It's lovely. And yeah, it's just a real kind of landmark achievement in terms, it just forces me to kind of look back on everything, on why this is so special to me and how I got here. And in many ways, this really is just the beginning for me. You know, I think now people are recognizing me for what I'm worth and what I'm capable of. And it's just a really humbling feeling. And yeah.
Absolutely. What are some, as you're looking back, are there other past roles that you look at now and you say that made me a better actor, or that was another major moment for me?
I mean, weirdly, a lot of the things in my early career, like Romulus, My Father, to look back and see, like, at 8 years old, I was dealing with such heavy subjects, and they weren't just fabricated, but they were based on real life events. And I remember, you know, meeting the guy that I played, Raymond, who grew up to be a philosopher. And, you know, I expressed the narrative of his life as a young person. Those are such meaningful moments to me. And then, of course, The Road as well, working with Viggo Mortensen. I think he set the bar for, I don't really look up to actors a lot, to be honest. And I feel I'm very different to many of them. And I think it has a lot to do in terms of just how I was introduced to the industry and what is now my career. But if there was any I look up to and admire, it's Viggo Mortensen. And I mean that more so for how he carries himself off screen and how he participates in the industry and how he's still respected, but he's kind of under the radar in many ways. That just has profoundly affected me, and I will always remember my journey with him. And I guess Matt Reeves as well, another one. I guess it was all of those in a line: Romulus, My Father, The Road, and Matt, Let Me In was right after that.
Yep.
And that film overall was just very cool, the setting, and another adaptation of a book. But I just grew very close with Matt Reeves, and he kind of let me into his world, and I took on a lot in terms of just like being a sponge and watching how he does what he does as a director and as a filmmaker. And that's, I think, the first time I felt really inspired to want to be able to do my own stuff one day if I want to go down that path. It's a great deal of stress and a huge weight upon the shoulders if I've taken anything else away from it. But yeah, and I loved working with him, you know, again on something like Planet of the Apes, which is of course more of a franchise thing, but I think he did amazing justice to that story and made it very unique. So yeah, many, many people I've worked with, most of them in fact, have played a huge part in the development of who I am today and why I love what I do so much.
Mm-hmm. Having come of age in the industry in that way, and you know, you said this marks a kind of a new beginning for you. Do you feel more equipped given that to navigate that next stage and have, you know, having all that under your belt and having seen so many different kinds of actors and directors work?
I guess so, but it's nothing I think of like really subjectively in that way. Like in the same way, the nerves that I feel before I start a project, which I like to label as excitement and just being positive, are the same nerves that I felt on the first day of, you know, Romulus, My Father. I think it's really important to remind yourself of the mind of innocence, as it does things for the moment and it doesn't think of anything outside of that or in the future or the past. I think that's very important. But definitely, of course, the more wisdom that I acquire through experiences, the better equipped I am for my future endeavors and possibly any other avenues that I might want to go down creatively to transmute from a hobby into a career. So yeah, definitely experience is huge.
All right, Cody. Well, I can't wait to see what you do next. Those are all my questions for you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Good to see you again.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
And finally, we'll hear the conversation that I had with James Samuel, who is the director of The Harder They Fall, the Western that is out on Netflix right now with this massive, almost entirely Black cast. And he just speaks really effusively about how long he's loved Westerns, how long he wanted to see a Western with someone who looked like him in it, and that kind of reclaimed the history of the Old West that did have a lot of people of color in it who were left out of traditional Westerns, and the music in it and the actors. And we had a really fun conversation. So let's listen to that. Thank you so much for doing this. I know your big press push was a couple weeks ago, so hopefully you're ready to get back in the Harder They Fall mindset.
I never leave the Harder They Fall mindset, ever. Press, no press, I'm always talking. I've been talking about the Harder They Fall once since I was a kid, but a good 15 years. Yeah. And then 10 years when I started sketching out what the film would be. You know, like I speak about the Harder They Fall all the time. And also, I love talking, so.
Well, and like something like that doesn't leave you. You know, just because the movie's out doesn't mean that the world of the film can leave your brain when it's been part of you for so long.
Absolutely. And it, you know, chances are it never will. It's such a dynamite piece of work. And also, I'm not at all mature. Like when, you know, the mature way to be or the grown-up way to be would be like, yes, well, you know, when I made The Harder They Fall, it was a, you know, an experience of such a... I ain't like that, man. I'm from the hood. I'm like, woo, this film's amazing. So
you got to make like 50 more films, then maybe you can feel you can leave them behind.
Yeah, and even then, you know, never grow up. You know what I mean? Some of my favorite directors, they still have all that energy. Like when you see Scorsese speaking about his movies, he still turns into like a kid and speaking about things in his fast kind of voice. And it's film gives us life.
Yeah. No, Scorsese is like the absolute best representation of how, no matter how old you get, that like enthusiasm that brings you to movies does not have to go away.
Doesn't have to go away. Quentin's like that as well.
They both talk really fast too. I wonder if that's a coincidence.
But he's always energetic, and it's really refreshing thing when people are excited about their art, you know, and what they create is a beautiful thing. I think something we should all hold on to.
I don't mean to start at the ending, but you talking about staying in the word of the harder they fall. In one other interview, you said you'd always thought of it as a three-parter. Is that still in your head now that it's out in the world, the further versions of it?
Yeah, 100%. I've always imagined the harder they fall as like a prequel and a sequel. Always. Like, I've always been sketching out the stories of both. And then also just like the whole universe of that side of the West. You know, the whole universe of not even the whole universe. Basically, the whole Old West. If you take away the narrow, white male, centric stories we were given, then that means you have a whole universe of stories with women, of actual dominance, with people of color, all races. Like, you have a whole genre. Basically, you have a genre where 90% of it is unexplored. So I'll always be going back to the Old West. I love it too much. I love it too much. And, you know, people think they don't like Westerns. Or a lot of people would say, oh, man, The Harder They Fall, such a dope movie, and I don't even like Westerns. It shows that you do like Westerns. You just haven't been given the vitamins and the echinacea and the stuff that you needed. And then the Lord made James Samuel.
I didn't grow up loving Westerns, and then kind of learned to love them in my life. And I love what you have said about kind of growing up with them, and they were part of the water and you really fell into them. But I can't imagine that there were a lot of kids growing up around you who also love Westerns. Were you always just on your own being like, no guys, these are great, and just trying to convince people to get on board?
Well, the older I got, yeah. But not when I was a kid. When I was a kid, they were just on TV all the time. So you would just be watching them with everything else. They were on television all the time. Now, they were reruns and repeats, right? This is the TV shows. You know, because England is just obsessed with anything American. And England is obsessed with two cultures, Americans and Australians.
Huh.
Right? So we have Australian programming as if you'd catch English television first thing in the morning and around 3:30, 4 p.m. And it's just Australian TV, right? Home and Away, Neighbours, all of these soap operas.
Yeah.
So Heartbreak High, I remember I used to watch that before, just after The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
That's a good combo.
Yeah, with this guy that was kind of like a Heath Ledger dude, and he was Australian. He wasn't Heath Ledger, but my point is, when I was a kid, they were just always on TV. So everyone watched them, right?
Yeah.
You didn't have to watch them, but your parents were watching them. And if you're going to be kind of in the same room as your parents at any time, you're going to be watching the Westerns. Even something like Little House on the Prairie is a Western.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? So all of these things, even The Waltons is a Western somewhat, right? But they were just more family-oriented and things. But like Bonanza, Rawhide, you know, all these black and white things that were just on TV. Champion, the Wonder Horse. Hollywood used to make more films about horses than they did about black people. They'll give a horse its own TV show. And, black people wouldn't even get looking. But as I got older, you'd find less and less people that like Westerns. I still love them. But less and less people I'd find would like Westerns. And I think it's because of the content.
Mm-hmm. Because of the, white male-centric, you know, take the land from people ideology in a lot of them.
Every woman subservient or prostitute, even white women, every woman is subservient or prostitute. There's no women of any power. If you look at Joan Crawford, one of the greatest actors of all time, when she's in the Western, it's Johnny Guitar. It's still named after the man. This woman was like one of the biggest actors in the world. Yeah. It's still named after a man. It's the man's story. And then, you know, but she's the person on the poster, but it says John Crawford in Johnny Guitar. Like, Hollywood just could not give women any shine in that genre. And they definitely wouldn't give any person of color any human or humane narrative. So I think people just tune out of those things. They just would never catch people. For whatever reason, the ground, the golden ground, the dialogue, the standoffs, the everything would just attract, the horses, everything would just attract me about a Western. But in my yearning for a broader landscape of storytelling, you know, I ended up just making my own.
I love you talk about yearning for a broader landscape, which is like the theme of every Western, is like wanting a more space and wanting to get out to some golden land. It's like the theme of a Western was your life leading you to making a Western.
Yeah, I was literally experiencing that, watching those guys looking for their broader pastures. I'm like, can we get some broader pastures with the camera? Because if the person yells cut and just turns to the left, you'll probably see a person of color. Or woman with dominance. But as soon as they yell action, it's the craziest thing. It's the craziest thing. More so than any other genre that Hollywood would produce.
Well, it's like the Western, it fell out of favor like in the 60s and 70s when Hollywood starts, you know, expanding in some way. So it's like just in time when they might have put other people in Westerns, they decided to stop making them and it never got a chance to catch up.
It never got a chance to flurry. And then once in a while, Clint Eastwood would make a Western, you know, Pale Rider or Unforgiven. They'll be wicked, wicked, wicked movies. But again, they'll fall into the tropes of the Old West. I think every woman in Unforgiven is a prostitute.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just like, you know, in High Noon, like the most interesting female character in Westerns and the classic ones is the woman who's a prostitute. She's fascinating, but that's still her role.
It's crazy. It's the craziest thing. Like, so when people, I read that James Samuel's revisionist Western or has reimagined the Old West. I ain't reimagined nothing. Hollywood reimagined the Old West, but I'm just giving them a broader viewpoint of what, you know, life was like.
But you also fictionalized it. And like on Western, all original Westerns are too. You took these real people and you kind of said, here is a version of the story. These people are real, as it says in the beginning. Was there ever a part of you that thought you would make something more historical? Or was it always going to be, here's my fictional but emotionally true version?
No way. I couldn't make something historical because then we'll only be speaking about one character. Like if I took the story of Bass Reeves, okay, but then no one will be speaking about Nat Love, Jim Beckwith, Bill Pickett, Stagecoach Mary, Gertrude Smith, Wiley Esco. We wouldn't be speaking about none of these people. If I took the story of Nat Love, we wouldn't be speaking about Bass Reeves, Stagecoach Mary. What I did was assemble them all like the Avengers. And so we could be speaking about all of these characters. At no point did I want to make a historical biopic because I want to have all the things I love about Westerns in them. I love the genre of the Old West. Bank robberies, train robberies, jailbreaks. In The Harder They Fall, I don't think this has ever been done before. I put a train robbery and a jailbreak in the same scene.
Why not? They have prisoners on trains, why not?
Exactly, right? So I put a bank robbery, train robberies, jailbreaks. Like, I love this. I love this stuff. And I love all of those characters so much. I can't choose which one to just, you know, make one story about. I remember being on set and I'd look at both gangs. I'm like, this is amazing. On one hand, the quote unquote good guys are who was the goodies in real life. Nat Love, Bill Pickett, Bass Reeves, Jim Beckwith, Cathay Williams, aka Cuffy, Stagecoach Mary. On the flip side is the baddies, people who are outlaws in real life. Even though everyone's outlaws in the film, but
yeah,
real dangerous people, was Gertrude Smith, Cherokee Bill, Rufus Buck in the infamous Rufus Buck game. I guarantee you, we would never, ever, ever have seen a film with Rufus Buck in it. No one's talking about this character. If I'd have made you know, a historical thing, just isolated one character, one story, I needed to make the Western that was in my brain with all of the Barrington Levy on the score and the dub and all of the music embellishments. I needed to make a James Samuel Western, but I wanted everyone to talk about these characters, so I needed to assemble them like superheroes.
And was there the feeling like you've worked so long to make this, like if you only get one shot, you got to put it all out there in case you never get to make another Western after this?
No, I mean, I never really thought like that, only because, Katie, like, I come from the hood. I'm going to make this movie, and then I'm going to make more. Like, my brain is so optimistic with that stuff. I'm going to make this movie. This movie is going to be dope. Then I'm going to go and make another one. Then I'm going to go and do a prequel. Then I'm going to go, like, my brain's like...
There's no plan B.
There is no plan B. Like, this is who I am as a human being. In fact, there's a plan B and a plan C and a plan D. Plan A, make the harder they fall. Plan B, make the harder they fall. C, harder they fall. And D, harder they fall. I've got all the plans for the alphabet, but I'm making the harder they fall.
Yeah, it's a first step in all of them.
Yeah, first step in all of them. I just loved the movie too much. And at no point through all the years of trying to get it made did I think I wouldn't get it made. At no point. I was just working towards completion. And you just, you know, you don't realize how much time has gone. You're just kind of reconfiguring the stars, so to speak, to make the universe obey your will. When I first had the idea, I think Netflix was still sending us DVDs in the post.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I never gave any of those DVDs back, Casey. I remember, like, I tried to rent another list, my account was just blocked. Like,
I hope they gave you your account back. Now you can get some Netflix.
Yeah, I don't think so. But what they did do was give me a huge budget to make The Harder They Fall. So
did they make up for it?
I think they've made up for it now.
Well, what do you know about who's watching it on Netflix? You know, you've had film festival premieres. It's been in theaters. You get some box office, but a ton of people are seeing it on Netflix. Do you get any information on who it's big with? What kind of feedback do you get?
I don't know. Like, we had one data call, and Tendo Negenda, our exec, because, you know, the people that kind of are the bosses of Netflix are really behind this movie. Ted Sarandos, Scott Stuber, and Tendo Negenda, who kind of like oversaw and shepherded this production through. We have conversations with him. He said it was doing really well. It was number one globally a few days ago, like last week.
I remember that.
And you know, he said it's doing amazingly, amazingly well. When they start throwing figures around, my brain kind of goes to mush. I'm like, all right, are a lot of people watching it? He said, a lot of people watched it. I was like, job well done.
And you get to see it with an audience in a theater and watch people connect with it, which is, you know, after the last year and a half, that's not to be taken for granted.
Yeah, a few times I watched it with people, like a few times, and it was amazing. We had the opening night gala at the London Film Festival, mm-hmm. which was like over 2,000 people. We had the first premiere back in LA, from my understanding, which was over 1,000 people. It's amazing for me to get to experience the film and all the laughs and all. And you see things, you know, this is my first feature. So I see things that there's no way I would have known had I not watched it with a crowd. Mm-hmm. Like jokes that work, or dramatic bits that work, or where the audience doesn't have a chance to breathe after, like, what happens to Jim Beckwith. It's so quick because they go to war. So I'm looking now with the audience, I'm like, wow, this is amazing. They haven't got a chance to breathe, but they can breathe when Cherokee Bill creeps up on Bill Pickett moments later. And they're like, oh. Or when Bill Pickett pulls out his coin. In both LA and the UK, Bill Pickett pulls out his coin and is like, I'll be damned. And the whole crowd go, whoa, whoa, whoa. Close shave. I'm like, really? Wait till he kisses the coin. Bang! Like, it's all that kind of stuff. I would not know the reaction of the crowd had I not been able to have a premiere.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you about the ending, since, you know, you did a lot of press before the movie came out, and if you're good with, you know, some spoiler warning or whatever. But we did my colleague interviewed Idris Elba for a while, and he talked about that big monologue he has at the end of the movie, which I think everyone watching that is like, well, hang on. Like, he's Idris Elba. He needs like a big, big, big scene, and it comes in almost at the very end. And that it wasn't in the script for him to cry in that scene, and that he did it. How did that play out? What was that like for you?
It was the most amazing thing, because my dad passed away when I was a kid, right? And the picture of the man in the mansion that is literally between them when they're talking is a painting of my father.
Wow.
And then they're both characters speaking about their dad, and all of us have really unique father experiences. Myself, Jonathan Majors, and Idris Elba. And I think it was just all coming out. And Jonathan was in tears, and Idris broke down in the scene as he's speaking to, or Rufus Buck. It was really a heavy, heavy scene. And I just broke down in tears watching it. And then after the scene, we were all consoling each other in tears, just all three of us. And the crew was crying, and people in hair and makeup that had the screens, that had the, you know, the feed, they were crying, but they were pretty much offset. It was crazy. Like, everyone was in tears, and it was a really, really heavy scene. I remember the following day, Idris had to come and do some reaction shots, you know, when he's looking through the window at Nat Love coming to town. And he went, "Whoa, James, man, I'm exhausted." I was like, "Oh, you got enough sleep?" He went, "No, not physically. I'm emotionally exhausted. Yesterday was really heavy. It was really heavy, James." I went, I didn't even know it was going to get that heavy, but it was heavy for all of us. It was a really, really beautiful thing.
Yeah. And then the ending, like the very ending when you see him go out and see Stagecoach Mary, like, it's not a triumphant moment. Like, it's a very bittersweet ending. And she asks him, "Is the devil dead?" And he says he doesn't know. And that's, again, like turning the Western genre on its head in some way. It's not a clear-cut ending. So that was, even though that scene turned out to be more emotional than maybe you expected, that was always the mood you wanted at the end. That, like, just emotional catharsis, but no good guy, bad guy in that ending.
I wanted with The Harder They Fall, to employ all of the Western tropes and then to turn everything on their head. I've never seen a Western where the protagonist meets the antagonist and then they just both break down in tears. I've never seen that in the West, where the man is just crying and then the villain, quote unquote, turns out to not be a villain. Really, I killed your parents because they killed my parents. Rufus, Nat Love's father killed Rufus Buck's mother and father because a kid just looks at their parents with absolute trust. If that's the way you behaved, you killed the idea of whatever idea of a father figure Rufus Buck had as a kid. His father killed it. His father murdered his dad and his mum, much like what Ben Kenobi was saying to Luke about your father was killed by Darth Vader.
Yeah. I mean, Star Wars is a Western, obviously. Like, it's got all those tropes.
Star Wars is a Western to the point where, you know, I was talking about like the stereotypical things in Westerns, how they'll portray people of color. Like, even in the spaghetti Westerns, the Mexicans would be the most superhero with bullets. I've never met a Mexican with bullets down his chest.
Yeah, every Western.
Yeah, and I still believe Star Wars being a Western, Chewbacca represents that stereotypical person of color that they'll show in those Westerns. I've never seen a Mexican with bullets down both sides of his chest, big, fat. I think what, and those weren't Hollywood movies, but I just think what we were fed as just women and people of color really damaged us and really damaged the way we view each other. Which is why I wanted to have fun with The Harder They Fall. I wanted to swag out in all in glorious Technicolor. I couldn't do that with just one biopic. I needed to tell my own story. You know what I mean? But still make it realistic. You become what you kill, have the cycle of violence. I'm killing him because he killed my parents. He killed my parents because he's my brother and they killed his parents. You know, just the whole cycle of violence and all, and put soul into something that could easily have been a shallow ending. I really wanted to put heart in it and tears. Is the devil dead? I don't know, because you just become Rufus Buck. So, you know, it's more that kind of stuff.
The Western trope that I always liked when I was watching a lot of them is so many of them will be about trying to build a community. You know, it's about like the sheriff comes to town and he tries to get the outlaws out, or they're trying to like build up a homestead somewhere else. And that is Rufus Buck's plot. And it's not revealed for like a good halfway through the movie. Like, you don't know that that's what he's up to. Why was that something you locked into for Rufus Buck specifically? Because he's an outlaw, but he's working for the greater good, really.
Thank you, Katie. You see, Katie, you said that because you are a gangster. Rufus Buck is not a baddie to me. To me, the author, Rufus Buck is not a baddie. Okay, when he kills that guy in cold blood, he kills him because he's an enemy of progress, right? I've never met a human being that wants to pay their taxes. Can't wait to pay my taxes. The government. The Rufus Buck gang are just the government. They're trying to build something that's a model for all of us. They are ruthless in upholding the law as the government. It doesn't mean they were outlaws because they operate outside the law. But film-wise, they don't do anything unscrupulous. Whereas they do things ruthless, like, what's your name? Bang. Whereas the minute you meet the Nat Love gang, they are killing the Crimson Hood gang in cold blood. Mm-hmm. They're killing the Crimson Hoods in cold blood.
Yeah.
Because they robbed the bank? That could have been the most friendly. There was no internet those days and no cell phones. For all we know, that bank robbery, and I love talking about this stuff because, as you can see, because I wrote it. But for all we know, that bank robbery could have been the most friendliest bank robbery that ever took place. The Crimson Hoods could have actually said, hey guys, look, we're going to work really hard to pay this money back. And they probably would have done. I'm just saying, we doubt it. But who knows? And they get killed in cold blood. So who's the baddie? It's about switching everything on its head. When the two women face each other off, while all the men have weapons and guns, those two women, like gangsters, throw their guns, toss their guns to the side and say, let's go. And go in it. Fisticuffs. Showing the men outside, you don't have to be doing, you can handle it this way. Fisticuffs. The attractive thing about The Harder They Fall was the ability to turn everything we know on its head. The showdown with Beckwith. Countdown for five, four, three, pew! Just turning everything that you expect on its head.
It breaks your heart, you know, because as soon as someone starts a countdown, you kind of worry that it's not going to make it down. And with that one, you really hope it's going to make it. And
it just doesn't.
It's that moment.
Yeah, the minute he says countdown for five, but he warns him. Nat Love is a dead man walking, but you don't have to be quick draw. Go back from whence you came and we leave it at that. No. Okay, countdown from five. The minute Beckwith starts counting, he's dead.
Yeah. This is something you read in a lot of people writing about this movie and about Idris Elba and Jonathan Majors, I think, mostly. But really everyone is there. All filmed like movie stars. Like the way the camera pays attention to these people, they are big name and light stars. And it's hard to, I think, for me to put my finger on what makes that happen. And obviously the actors are charismatic and that's part of it. But as a filmmaker, I'm assuming that that is your goal, that you want to film all these people looking incredible. So what do you do? What is the thing that you do behind the camera to make them look like giant movie stars the way they do in this movie?
I think a lot of it is casting, right? It's casting. Yeah. The minute you meet Arnold Schwarzenegger as a man in Conan the Barbarian, right? Like, he's pushing the thing. He's pushing the thing around, the turnstile, around. He's a young slave boy. And then and you see him with the sword. Celluloid just loves Arnold. But celluloid loves, even though we shot digitally, but film loves Regina King. It loves Lakeith Stanfield. So you also know, you have to know, I think, how to shoot these people. But then I also think that, just like meeting someone in real life, you kind of make up your mind in the first 10 seconds, the impression that the person has on you. Your brain either goes, or interesting, or save me, right? Meeting a character in a film is like your immediate reaction when on a blind date. So I believe what helps is the entrance, the introduction to these characters. And Nat Love has an amazing introduction. Jim Beckwith has an amazing, Brothers Grimes. Everyone has an amazing, Bill Pickett, upon my return. Everyone has an amazing, Cuffy fighting the guys at the door. Stage shows Mary, one, get that horse in a wagon. Trudy Smith, we ain't no nincompoop. Anyone, I think the introductions make up the audience's mind immediately and make you go, this is hard. Like Rufus Buck's introduction on the train.
Well, I mean, that's an entire scene's worth of an introduction.
That's an entire scene's worth of an introduction. I don't know. That's my favorite film introduction in a long time. It's my favorite Idris Elba cinematic introduction. I just think it's hard. So I think that helps as well. And then be fearless with your plans and aims for the camera. Be fearless with them, because the camera is the thing that tells the story. So I don't necessarily like mundane coverage of like over the shoulder reverse two shot for a conversation.
Yeah.
Over the shoulder reverse two shot. Come in for cutaways. It's such a bland way to tell the stories. I try to get in between the characters so I don't feel like they're talking outside of me. Because the camera tells a story, I believe that we have to utilize the camera in order to tell that story effectively. And which is why I go hard on my introductions and in the long shots, the cable cam from the back of the mansion right down to Jonathan Majors on his horse, from Rufus Buck, Idris Elba to Nat Love, Jonathan Majors, in one clean shot. I just believe the camera does it when you trust it. You have to have a conversation with the camera when you're storyboarding and stuff. Like, look, man, I want to try this. Does it work? The camera will tell you about crossing the axis. You're lying, you know, the camera, for the most part, doesn't lie.
Well, speaking of introductions, your title card, I noticed the when I was just rewatching it, that it's like a film projector skipping and freezing and shuttering. And I love that flourish. And I just wanted to know why that was what you wanted to do for your name at the beginning of the film.
You know, incidentally, I think when we were working on it, myself, my editor, Tom Eagles, he had put like a James Samuel logo and then kind of got rid of it with a flutter. I was like, that's kind of hard. This is real. This is real hard, Michael Jackson. This is hard, meaning great. This is real hard, Prince Roger Nelson. Like, I could dig it. And so we kind of just left it in there. And I love the sound of like a film projector. In the end, you may not have noticed, when they're riding off, it goes skinny.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was my love of Westerns when I was a kid. I was like, why does it always go skinny at the end? And I remember learning, obviously it's because they need to fit. They used to cut those movies for TV. They used to crop them, but they need to fit all the credits in. Otherwise, it would say Clint East and Lee Van Cleef. So they would squeeze it. So in homage to the Westerns, I squeeze the camera. I go skinny. And then just to give it that feel that I used to love. I'll probably do something like that in all my films.
The beginning and ending is such a spot for setting the tone, and then setting the tone for people leaving out there. Like, you really get to go big in those moments.
Exactly, exactly. And I think going big is exactly why we came. That kind of thing it leads into what you said about, you know, I'm going to put everything in there. I always say, obey your crazy. When you're creating, obey your crazy at all costs. Obey your crazy. Don't second guess it. Those thoughts are there for a reason. Go create, like, obey your crazy. Still keep within the parameters of the story that you're telling, but obey your crazy. And that's what I've done with The Hard Way Fall. I just wanted to obey my crazy and have the camera celebrate these people in front of it. So the camera could then relay its story to myself and Tom Eagles, and then we can relay it to everyone else.
Yeah. Maybe one last question. For anyone who's seen The Harder They Fall and maybe hasn't seen a bunch of Westerns and thinks, oh, this is cool, I want to do more of these, what would you send people to? Like, that are movies either like The Harder They Fall or that you just love and think people should see if they want to like Westerns?
I think I'll just send them to movies that I love, because I'll get away. I'll firstly, most any Western I send them would have those tropes that turn them off.
Yeah, that's true.
So I would just send them to movies I love and let them know that the only thing that makes a Western is its geographical time and placement, and not even necessarily the time these days. Because you watch that film with Ben Foster and Chris Pine, Hell or High Water, that's a Western,
yeah,
right?
Modern day.
Yes, a modern day Western. So I would show them films that I absolutely love and show them how they relate to what I did with The Harder They Fall. I'll show them just movies that I absolutely love. I'll show them The Graduate and its usage of the Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack to visuals is seamless and amazing. Hello, darkness, my old friend. Come to talk with you again. Beautiful. April, come she will. Well, thanks to you, Mrs. Robinson. Like, I'll show them that before I show them a Western. Then they'll understand my train of thought when I'm employing music in these particular scenes. And, you know, I would show them other films.
I would love to watch a double feature of The Graduate and The Harder They Fall. That'd be really fun. Please program that.
That'd be super hard. And I'll show you, like, particular things. I go, you remember that in The Harder They Fall? Now look here.
Yeah.
When he's on the bus, and I think they play The Sound of Silence. But he's on Dustin Hoffman's on the bus. To me, that's the equivalent of Nat Love coming from behind the bushes, and you hear a voice over the soundtrack, saying, away with the wind she goes. Well, away with the wind she goes. Then the camera comes around and you see it's Nat Love singing with the strings. Mm-hmm. As her garden grows, hold those flowers close. For away with the wind she goes. I'll be back with information by sunup. Like, it just all
talk about movie stars.
Yeah, it just all exists in my head, kind of, and then I kind of when I'm writing it out, just make it make sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's nobody else making movies like you, so whatever what you're doing is working, so thank you for making them that way.
Thank you so much. I think it just shows that I'm not all the way crazy.
That does it for this week's show. You can find us at vanityfair.com, where we're reviewing and reacting to a whole lot of the stuff that we're talking about that is just now emerging out into the world, which is so exciting. As mentioned, you can text us, joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen, or text 213-513-7118. We love answering your questions. You can find us on Twitter at littlegoldmen, and on our own, I am at Katie Rich, and Richard.
Rylos.
And David.
David Campfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
This week's episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best new title for this podcast goes to Rebecca Fort.
How are the shrimp doing?
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.